and for the opportunity to present my work here. It's my first time visiting here, and I'm really liking it. Okay, so implications of computer science principles for quantum physics is a work that we did with Gonzalo de la Torre and Antonio Asin from ICFO, and Gabriel Seno and Santiago Figueira from the Universidad de Buenos Aires, where I'm originally from. And the basic idea is that there are a few limitations to what classical computers can do, which are mainly written in the Church-Turing thesis that I will go into later on. And for computer scientists, this is more than a statement on what computers can do, but a statement on what classical systems can actually do when computing stuff, when using them to obtain results for problems. And what we did here is to see that these limitations for classical systems actually limit, in a sense, things that can be or cannot be done in quantum physics. Because usually we use classical resources, and these classical resources are limited by that. So we will tell you about two results in that direction. So first of all, I will start with the first problem that I will talk about, and I will show an intuitive result for that, which has to do with distinguishing different mixtures of pure state yielding the same mixed state. So for that, I will introduce some stuff for computability for physicists. I assume most of the people here are physicists. I'm not sure, but probably. Then I will go into that problem of distinguishing these undistinguishable mixes of states. Then I will go into some generalizations of that problem. Finally, another small result on a new sort of loophole for Bell inequalities related to the computability of the inputs of the parties on a Bell-like experiment. And finally, a summary of the results. So let's start with the first problem of mixed states. Imagine the following situation. We have R2D2 inside of a box. And on every run of an experiment, he picks either the zero or the one state. We are talking about single qubits here. And he sends that state out of the box. And this observer here, the only thing that he knows is that half of the times R2D2 will pick the zero state and half of the times the one state. But other than that, he doesn't know which state he will pick every time. He only knows that for the long run, but on every run, he doesn't know. So the best description that the observer can give for this is the identity. Okay? We can have a similar situation with C3PO, but he picks now states from the eigenstates of sigma x instead of eigenstate of sigma z, the plus and the minus. And again, the observer doesn't know which state he will pick each time, but he knows that on the long run, he will pick half of the times each state. So again, the observer thinks that the state is a maximally mixed state because he cannot make any prediction on what will come from the box. So both situations look undistinguishable. That's what textbooks say. However, they are robots, so the only thing they can do is to choose in a computable manner, that I will go into that in a short while. But basically, the only thing they can do is use the sort of randomness a computer can generate. What we will see is that, and also any classical system that they can use, like a classical coin or anything, also will yield computable results, because classical physics is simulable by a computer. And only because of that, the two situations will be distinguishable, okay? Only by that fact. So let's go into a little bit on what I mean by computable, just to know what we are talking about. In computability theory, they usually resort to what are called Turing machines, which are like our computers, but with infinite memory, and are described as this head that moves along an infinite tape. It has a set of instructions, so basically the head can read the symbol that is written on that position of the tape, and it decides based on the symbol that is written on that position and its internal state, it decides what to do. The possible actions are to write something on the tape, change its internal state and then move either to the right or to the left, okay? And what we can see is that these Turing machines are equivalent to every computer that we use nowadays, okay? In terms of computational power, they are the same. So we can describe this as one of these machines and everything works perfectly. Okay, so basically, by studying these systems, we get to know what a classical computer can do. And the Church-Turing thesis is that anything that can be computed as a series of steps on a system, on a classical system, which is called effectively calculable, can be computed by a Turing machine. And the Turing machine is equivalent to this computer. So basically, anything that we can think of as an algorithm working on any classical system, it doesn't matter if it's a computer or anything else, are the same family of functions that a computer can compute. So some properties of these Turing machines that we will use all along. First, the different Turing machines or different programs that we can run on a universal computer are computably enumerable, which means that we can write a program that lists all the possible programs that we can run on a computer. Another interesting property is that some programs don't ever halt on some inputs. They run forever, but it's impossible to know if a program will run forever or not, because the halting problem, which is tell me if this program, this given program, will ever halt, is not computable. Then another interesting property is that most infinite sequences, I'm talking about binary sequences, are not computable. Then another interesting thing, which is relating to the sort of randomness that a classical computer can generate, there are absolutely normal sequences that are computable. An absolutely normal sequence is a sequence in which every subsequence that we can think of appears on that sequence with the same frequency, okay? So we pick any binary sequence of any finite length and it appears inside there with the same frequency, okay? And that in the absolutely here refers to that works in any basis in which we write that sequence on, okay? Then, of course, every finite sequence is computable because it's trivial to write a program that writes a single string. And because of that, every finite sequence is a prefix for infinitely many computable sequences and infinitely many uncomputable sequences, okay? If I give you a finite prefix, you can continue it with a computable sequence and it will be computable, or with a non-computable sequence and it will be not computable, okay? Just because you can write the program that writes that prefix and then goes on with a different program, either something computable or with something else, it won't be a program, but the whole sequence won't be computable, okay? So back to our example. We have R2-D2, and he can only generate computable sequences because he's a robot, but if he had any classical system, like a classical coin or anything, it will also be computable sequences. But still, from the observer's perspective, seems that this description for the next qubit that comes from the box is fair, because no matter what he has seen before from the sequence, the next bit can be either a 0 or a 1, and the whole sequence still be computable. Okay, so it still looks like a fair description, but still we will be able to distinguish. We will see later on. And okay, it might be that they can distinguish because the proper state is not this one, but a little different. But for that reason, that the next bit can be either a 0 or 1, it's not clear what the proper description should be for this situation. I mean, the robot picks these two states using a program. That's all we know about how he picks. So what's the description for the next qubit? Still looks like the maximally mixed state is fair. Of course, the observer doesn't know which program the robot is using, otherwise it's trivial. So how can we distinguish these two situations? So we will assume that we have a black box containing either of the two situations, and we want to know which one of these two situations we have. Either the robot is picking eigenstates of sigma z or of sigma x, okay? So what we will do as observers, we will measure every other qubit that comes from the box on the basis of eigenstates of sigma x, and every even qubit on the basis of eigenstates of sigma z. Okay, like this. Measure the first one on the basis of sigma x, the second sigma z, etc. Okay, and this yields two infinite sequences. I say infinite sequences because they are potentially infinite in the sense that you can request as many qubits as you want from the box, but at the end of the day, I will only request finitely many. Okay, but as mathematical entities, these sequences are infinite because I can see as many bits as I want. Okay, so I have these two classical binary sequences that I can input into a classical computer. And these two sequences have a distinctive property, which are that when we measure in the same basis as the preparation, the sequence obtained is computable, because if the robot was preparing eigenstates of sigma x, this would be bits from the sequence that the robot is using, okay? So it will be only the other bits from a computable sequence, and this is another computable sequence. But when we measure in the wrong basis, the sequence obtained looks like a fair coin tossing, because we are preparing eigenstates of sigma x and we are measuring sigma z, or the other way around. So this is a classical problem. We need to distinguish a random sequence from a computable one, because one of the sequences is computable, the one from the right shows of basis, and one is random. Can we distinguish that? And the classical answer is no. You cannot distinguish a random sequence from a classical coin. However, the problem we had here when starting to work with computer scientists was that we were speaking different languages. For us physicists, usually when we say random sequence, we mean that we have a probability distribution on the space of sequences, and we pick a sequence from that probability distribution, okay? But for computer scientists, they call a random sequence a syntactic property of a single sequence. I mean, you give them a sequence, although they cannot compute that, but it's a property of that sequence being random or not, okay? And basically the definition they use is that almost every prefix of the sequence is uncompressible. So every new bit you add to the sequence gives one new bit of information. You cannot compress most of the prefixes, okay? So it's a property of a single sequence being random or not. So we still had hope, because the problem that we needed to solve in order to distinguish the two situations was, can we distinguish a computable sequence from one arising from a fair coin tossing with high probability of success? Okay, and this turned out to be true, and we were able to do so. And so far we have that the problem of distinguishing the two computable preparation of the same mixed state is translated into distinguishing a computable sequence from a fair coin tossing. And so this classical problem is the one we will see now, and we'll go into detail, okay? So how does it work, the way to distinguish a computable sequence from a fair coin tossing? This is now completely classical. We have two infinite sequences, x and y, and we have the warranty that one of these is computable and the other comes from a fair coin tossing. That's all our assumptions, okay? So the hand-wavy idea will be to take a long enough prefix from the first sequence. We call x harpoon n, the first n bits from the infinite sequence x, okay? Then we take a long enough prefix from y. And then since all the programs that a Turing machine can run are computably enumerable, we can go one after the other on the programs until we find one of the programs that generates either of these two prefixes, which we know it will happen at some point because one of the sequences was generated by a program, and we are going through all programs. And then we will conclude that that one is the computable sequence. Of course, this is not so easy because there are several technical problems there. First, what does it mean to take a long enough prefix of both of the sequences? Long with respect to what? The second problem we have is that we might get a false positive to identify the fair coin as a computable sequence, because nothing forbids the fair coin for giving you 100 times tails. And of course, you look at that and it looks like a computable sequence. So we can have a false positive, and we need to bound the probability of having a false positive. And then the most computer side problem is that some of the programs never halt, and you cannot tell which. So how do you enumerate the programs and run them to obtain prefixes if you don't know if you have to wait longer or just stop the program because it will never halt? So how do you generate all the prefixes from every program, okay? So I will show you now how to deal with these problems, which will solve the original problem of distinguishing. So first, what does it mean to have a long enough prefix of both of the sequences? We will be testing one program after another, okay? So every program P, we will call length of P, this modulus of P, is the length of the description of the program. Every program that we test, we will compare against prefixes of the sequences of length k times the length of the program, where k is a constant that we can set by hand, okay? And we will compare these prefixes of length k times the length of the program with the output of the program P, okay? So if we are testing a short program, we'll take prefixes much longer than the description of the program to compare with the output of that program. Okay. Of course, the second problem we had is that we might get a false positive, meaning that we might identify the wrong sequence as a computable one. But we will see now that the probability of making an error will go to zero as k goes to infinity. So if we choose this constant k large enough, and it's not even that large, the probability of making an error can be bounded by a function of k, which goes exponentially fast to zero. So I think with k equal to 10 or 12, the probability of making a mistake is 1 in a million or something like that. So we don't need to have that large k. And the third problem we have, which is that some programs never halt, what we will do is to dovetail between program numbers and execution time. So what is it to dovetail? We will take, if we take in this axis and we write the program number that we are testing in each time, and in this axis, the time steps we will allow each program to run, okay? So we are not running the programs for unlimited amount of time, but we will limit with a parameter. So after this many time steps, we stop the program, okay? So we will start by running first program one time step, then first and second program for two time steps, then the first, second, and third program for three time steps, and so on, okay? So imagine if this is the right program that the box is using, okay? And this is the amount of time this program needs to generate the prefix k times the length of the program. At some point, we will reach this point here, which is the very same program run by a longer amount of time than needed, okay? So with this, we can guarantee that this algorithm always stops and gives an answer. Because no matter what program the box is using, at some point, we are certain that we will get to that program with an amount of time larger than the one we need in order to obtain a long enough prefix, okay? So this will solve the problem of programs that never halt, okay? We just go like this. We are certain that this algorithm will find the solution. It can be the case that instead of getting here, once we are here, this program generates the prefix of either of the sequences. And in this case, we might get a false positive. We might misidentify the computable sequence. But we are sure because of this that this algorithm will always give an answer, okay? So the algorithm, just to go a little more technical, goes like this. As an input, we have this constant k that we can choose by hand in order to bound the probability of making an error. And we have x and y, which are two infinite sequences that we will treat as oracles, which means that we can ask as many bits as we want for both of the sequences. And we know that one of them is computable, okay? And as an output, we want to have x or y as the candidate for being the computable sequence. So what we will do is we will have two nested loops in order to do the dovetailing that I showed before, one for the maximum time that we allow each program to run, and one for the program number that goes from zero to the maximum amount of time that we let the programs run. So if a universal Turing machine running program P for time T gives a prefix of length k times the length of the program that we are testing, then we will output x and halt. And the same, if the universal Turing machine running program P for time T sees a prefix from sequence y, we will output y and we will halt. Okay, so we'll give an answer. So as I told you before, this algorithm always halts because either x or y is computable, so we know that exists a program P that generates either one of those, and at some time we will reach that program with a long enough time and we will give that answer and we will halt. Okay, so the only possible error here is a misrecognition. So when can we have a misrecognition with this algorithm? It can only happen if the coin, the fair coin tossing, produces a sequence of length k that is computable by a program of length 1, because we are comparing outputs of programs of length 1 with prefixes of length k, or the coin produces a sequence of length 2k that can be generated by a program of length 2, and so on. Okay? However, there are at most 2 to the m sequences that can be generated by programs of length m, because there are 2 to the m different programs of length m. Not all the programs generate sequences, because some of the programs never halt, but at most we have 2 to the m different sequences, different computable sequences. But we have 2 to the mk different sequences of length mk. Remember that every program of length m, we will check against prefixes of length m times k, okay? So there are many more sequences that come from a fair coin than the ones that are generated by programs of length m. Okay, so how often does a coin give a prefix that is computable by a program that is k times shorter than the prefix we are looking? And this is easy to see because we have the different amount of computable sequences over the number of prefixes of length k times l that arise from a fair coin. We sum this over the all possible lengths of programs, okay, and this gives a geometrical sum that we can add and see that it's exponential, exponentially goes to zero. So basically, if we pick a k such that the error is lower than what we want, and then we run this recognition algorithm, we will have a correct answer with the probability of error as low as we want in finite time. It's important to see that. Let me go back to this dovetailing graph. For every program, we are looking only finite prefixes, okay? So it doesn't matter how long it takes for this program to give an answer, we will only be seeing finitely many bits, okay? That's why we can distinguish this property in finite time. So some subtleties. This algorithm runs in finite time, as I said, but it takes extremely long. And by extremely long, I mean this is by no way a practical thing to do. However, this proves that the state has some information on how it was mixed, okay? If we mix computably the zero and the one state, or the plus and the minus state, somewhere on the state there's information about how it was prepared, okay? Also, there are some computable sequences that look random to the naked eye, but are not. For instance, we can use as the random sequence, as a computable sequence, the binary expansion of pi starting from whatever point, and this algorithm will find that, because all in all, the binary expansion of pi is quite simple. Although it looks complex, it doesn't have much more information than the number pi. There are absolutely normal computable numbers, so there are many things that look computable but are not, and this algorithm can distinguish all of them. And of course, all the trick comes from the fact that computer programs are not random variables. Okay? However, the only way that we have to avoid this is using a quantum coin for a random number generator. As far as we assume here, a quantum coin is random because we assume that for the random sequence. And that's the only way we have to avoid this. If we use classical resources to mix classical states to produce a mixed state, we will fall into this. Okay? So we won't be preparing the actual state that we think we are preparing. So why this works? The basic idea behind why this algorithm works is that computer programs usually give simple outputs. And I'm saying this in a Kolmogorov complexity sense. The output of a program doesn't have more information than the program itself, because by giving you just the program, you can generate that sequence. So basically, if you have a program, the output from it is quite simple in that sense. You can obtain 1 billion digits, but it's still all codified in a short program. Okay? On the other hand, a coin, a fair coin, typically gives complex outputs. And this means that with probability one from a fair coin tossing, if you could toss a fair coin infinitely many times, that would give you sequences that are random in an algorithmical sense. I mean, that every prefix is uncompressible. And what our protocol does is to bound the Kolmogorov complexity of prefixes of the sequences by finding one program that generates that. If you find one program that generates a long prefix, that means that that long prefix has a short complexity because there is a short program that generates that, okay? And just by that, we can distinguish these two situations. So a little on variations about this. Instead of using just single qubit states, we could use mutually unbiased bases, which are the generalization of the basis of eigenstates of sigma x, sigma y, and sigma z for larger dimensions. These are bases in which if you take a state from one basis and you measure on any other basis, you obtain all the state from the second basis with equal probability. So it's a generalization of a fair coin. And of course, the algorithm works the same way. Then another generalization is that we can give more freedom to Alice. Instead of using just two orthogonal directions for the single qubit, if we allow Alice to choose k different directions on the block sphere and prepare states of either one of these k different directions, we can still use the same algorithm with only one different thing. What Bob will do, he will measure states from each one of the bases every time, okay? We'll make a measurement. He will obtain the k different sequences from the different directions that Alice used to prepare the state. And he will have to find one that is not run. Well, he will have to find the one that is computable, because there are many ones that are not computable, although they are not random. Because if you have two directions that are close, if this is computable, this one will be almost computable, but not computable, okay? Well, and here the trick, depending on the distribution of directions, the trick will be that Bob can start checking programs of a certain length. He will skip all the shortest programs, and he will start checking just from a certain length, and this will do the trick, and the algorithm will work, and it will finish with arbitrarily high probability of success, giving the correct answer. So even in this case in which the preparations are not orthogonal, Bob can do the same trick. And there's one other extension that I forgot to put here, which is all this is noise tolerant. The only thing we need to do to make this noise tolerant is to, instead of checking that the program generates a prefix of either of the sequences, we check that the program generates something whose Hamming weight with the prefixes is lower than a certain amount. And this also works. We need to change the k. We need to make k a little bigger to obtain the same probability of error, but it still works. Okay? I think the limit error is like you cannot have more than 20% of bit flips on the sequences, which is quite a lot. Okay, so this is as far as the first problem goes. This is one of the consequences of the Church-Turing thesis for quantum physics. I will go now to the second problem, which will be a little shorter, which is the Bell loophole. And what we will do here is we will discuss a Bell scenario, and we will see that this Church-Turing thesis has a consequence also for Bell-like experiments. So, well, probably you are all familiar with the Bell setup. We have two boxes with two inputs and two outputs, okay? This system is local if and only if the probability distribution can be written as a convex combination of products of local probability distributions. Okay, they do the experiment, they join the results, and then they have to check if the probability can be written this way or not. In any other case, the distribution is called non-local, and we all know that quantum mechanics allow for that. And an easy way to check if a probability can be written like this is to check if it violates a Bell inequality, for instance, the CHSH, for this case of two inputs, two outputs, and two parties. Okay? This inequality is satisfied by every local distribution, but it can be violated by quantum mechanics with the non-local distributions. So what we will do is we will introduce an eavesdropper that prepares the boxes locally on every round of the experiment and uses information on every input from the previous rounds of both of the parties. This has been studied in several papers and it's called the memory scenario, in which they have memory on the previous rounds. And they use that in order to make a local model that violates the Bell inequality. But still, with this, you can see non-locality, even with this memory, but not if the inputs are computable. So a description of the Bell scenario is we have the two boxes. After each round, Alice's box, for instance, for an eavesdropper, obtains the information on the inputs from both boxes and uses that information to prepare the two boxes for the next round and so on, okay? And of course, if at some point that eavesdropper can predict the forthcoming inputs by Alice and Bob, the eavesdropper can prepare the boxes in a way to give whatever distribution she wants, okay? If she wants what they will press on the next round, it's easy to prepare the boxes to do whatever distribution you want, even non-physical distributions as the PR box or whatever. Because if you can predict the inputs, then you can do whatever you want. So the problem of what happens when the inputs are computable comes to the learnability of infinite sequences from prefixes. This means, given a prefix of a computable sequence, can we guess the next bit? And this has already been studied by Solomonov, Gold, Seumann, and there are many more. So what's the idea for this learnability thing? If we have any time or space bounded complexity class, for instance, P and P, any of these computer complexity classes that we all know, we can see that all these time or space bounded complexity classes can be learned from prefixes. It means that seeing a long enough prefix, you can start guessing correctly all the bits that come after that from any sequence from that sequence. And the idea is quite simple. All these classes are computably enumerable, and all these classes are total functions, which means that every time they give a bit. So we can enumerate all the sequences from that class computably, because they are computably enumerable. The idea is that you just run all the programs with a time limit that is basically the time complexity. Okay, so you can enumerate all of them. And after you've seen a few bits, for instance, 101, you look on this table for the first sequence from the class that starts with 101, and you use the next bit as the guess. Okay? And since the sequence that we are looking for is one of this class, it will show up on this list at some point, okay? So at some point, since we are only moving forward here and we are only seeing sequences that are different from that one, we will reach that very sequence that Alice is using and the same for the Bob side, okay? So we are certain that at some point we'll start guessing correctly every single bit that comes after that, okay? The only problem here is that we don't know how many bits we need to see in order to predict correctly, but we know that if we wait long enough, for from some point on, we will start predicting correctly. Okay? So basically, if Alice and Bob use computable functions, this means that they belong to some time complexity class, which is exactly the complexity class defined by the function itself. I mean, you take the function, it takes some time to generate each bit, so it's, there's a time complexity class. They cannot rule out an eavesdropper that is learning a class bigger than the one they are using. For instance, if Alice and Bob are using functions from P, maybe the eavesdropper is learning the class NP, which includes P, and they cannot rule out that. And the eavesdropper, by choosing the class he decides to learn, if you want to see this the other way around, forces Alice and Bob to have to resort to harder functions. For instance, the eavesdropper can decide to learn the class NP because it's a decision for the eavesdropper. He decides he wants to learn the class NP. If he has enough computational resources, he can do that. Then he's forcing Alice and Bob to go to a class harder than NP to generate sequences that the eavesdropper cannot learn. Okay, so in a way, you can say that the eavesdropper shows how difficult it is for Alice and Bob to show a proper violation of Abel inequality. Okay? So one property and one random thought about this. Once the very sequence that Alice is using or Bob is using is learned, the overhead is small. Because once we got to the sequence that Alice is using to generate the next bit, it's just simulating that program for the next bit. And this has a really small overhead, okay? So the computational resources for the eavesdropper are pretty much the same as we have for Alice and Bob. So we don't know, we don't need to give the eavesdropper so much computational power. And the other thing, which is more like a random thought, is the following. The first bits that they use for the inputs, although they are computable, might give a proper violation. The eavesdropper didn't learn the sequence so far, so he doesn't know what programs they are using, so he cannot do this local model thing. So it looks like the first bits actually work to show a violation. However, is this violation valid if in the long run we know there is a local model? I mean, we know that for the long run, if they run the experiment long enough, they will have a local model, which is learning the sequences and using that. So are the first bits that show a violation with certain probability valid or not to show real non-locality? I don't know. You said yes. I'm not sure. Because usually what you do when you take probabilities is use them as the approximation of the long run. And actually, in the long run, that doesn't work. So, OK. I don't completely disagree with you, but I cannot say I agree completely, okay? So this is pretty much everything I had to say. So as a summary, if we mix a state by mixing pure state in a computable way, taking a computer to pick different pure states, somehow they retain information about the basis that was mixed to prepare that by the only assumption that they are mixed in a computable way. Furthermore, we presented an algorithm to distinguish two mixtures that were prepared in a computable way, that without that requisite of computability were undistinguishable. So only adding the computability thing, they became distinguishable. This implies that the only way to properly prepare a mixed state will be to use some non-computable resources, whatever that means. Maybe a quantum random number generator. I don't know of any other non-computable resource. And even here, this is an assumption that quantum mechanics gives non-computable results. And then the second result we showed is that in a Bell experiment, if Alice and Bob use computers to generate their inputs, or again, any computable system, we don't know if the brains are computable or not, but if they use a classical coin or whatever classical system, they cannot rule out an eavesdropper preparing their boxes. And the other way to look at this is that an eavesdropper can decide how hard it is for Alice and Bob to show a proper violation of Bell inequalities. So thank you. Yes.
So in quantum theory, if I measure a basis that's Bayesian and biased to the basis in which I'm preparing systems, necessarily that sequence of outcomes will be algorithmically random.
We're assuming
that. You're assuming this. Now, I presume that's because, you know, the textbooks say that, you know, the outcomes of quantum measurements are somehow objectively random and nothing. But if I take a different view of quantum theory, like say I take the de Broglie-Bohm interpretation, so in that view, the outcomes of measurements are determined by the invariables. There is no objective probability. And if I maybe finessed it by saying that the initial state configuration of the universe in my Bohmian theory is not any old particle configuration, but some computable particle configuration. Maybe I select a computable sequence at random. So now, according to that interpretation, these quantum sequences will also be algorithmically non-random. They'll be computable sequences.
Okay. First of all, you have to agree that it's not only a matter of interpretation, because now you have an experiment to distinguish the two things.
Well, that's not a feasible experiment, because you can't compute the Kolmogorov complexity of sequence.
Well, but you don't need to compute it. You need to bound it. And okay.
I mean,
I see your point. I think the only thing we need to assume, which is equivalent to having random outputs, is that if you take several qubits on the same basis, for instance, you take several qubits on the x basis, and you measure sigma z to all of them, you obtain all the results with the same probability. Okay, but I agree with you. In that case, you don't have a random quantum mechanics. In that case you mentioned, it's not a random number generator. So yes, I agree that this doesn't work. But I think it's more than a matter of interpretation. I'm not sure. You agree that it's not a random number generator in that case?
Sorry, in the case
you mentioned, the one interpretation with computer.
I can imagine an interpretation wherein even the outcomes of the experiments that you called algorithmically random would be computable. And so I guess it comes down to the question of, is it really feasible to try to experimentally determine whether quantum mechanics does yield computable sequences or not?
No, I don't think it's feasible to do it. If you restrict the class of computable sequences, you can, but then you cannot rule out computability. You can rule out, for instance, this class of functions. Yes.
So I'm going to also make the opposite objection to the one that Rob made, which is, so you said that if Alice and Bob are using classical coin flips to choose which states to prepare. Because there are some people out there, I'm not necessarily one of them, but there are people out there who think that all probabilities are ultimately quantum probabilities. So in the sense that if I flip a coin, then ultimately it's some quantum fluctuation because the initial conditions are so sensitive that determines that. And so if that were true, again, you would have now a situation where both sequences are non-computable.
Sure. The assumption is that the sequence has to be computable for this to work. Of course, I mean, people from computability claim that the classical coin is computable. I tend to agree more to the other view that the classical coin will give an algorithmically random sequence, but you cannot prove either of those. But yes, it's true. What we need is to have a computable sequence inside of the box. If we have that, this works.
Can you go back to the algorithm?
Yes.
It's the main precondition. So this was the U sub T of P means you run P for T many time steps?
Exactly. This is a universal Turing machine that runs program P for T time steps.
And what if T time steps are not enough to give an output of length K times length of P?
Well, one detail I didn't say, we are using what are called the monotone Turing machines, which actually are a little variation of the Turing machines, but with equal computable power, which are Turing machines with two infinite types, okay? Well, one infinite type and one semi-infinite tape, okay? This second tape is the output tape, and is you can only move to the right, right and move to the right, okay? So you have the head, and on this tape, it can only write a new bit and move to the right. So you know that for longer times, this model will give you more bits. Okay? Well, so the time t that shows up there,
it might also just be an infinite loop or something, no? It might never return an additional bit.
Sure. It might never halt. But since the function we are using is computable, there is some time t such that this model of Turing machine gives a prefix of length k times modulus of p. Okay? Because if you wait long enough for any program that gives this number of bits, you will reach the time for that, so that this gives you so many bits. And the dovetailing guarantees that you will wait this long.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
Yes?
Just a detail. Am I correct that you didn't make use of the fact that the sequences aren't just any computable sequence, but those which have, in the long run, half zeros and half ones? You didn't avail yourself of that extra restriction?
Yeah, we don't need that. Now, the only moment in which I used that was to make this look like a paradox, in the sense that, right at the beginning, when we say that the best description seems to be this one, it's only in the case in which, in the long run, you obtain half of the times each. Just that. But yeah, it's true that to distinguish, you don't need that. But to make it, I mean, more paradoxical in a sense, yeah, it looks like this state, but after all, it's not. We don't know which state best describes this situation in which you are told that this is computable, but it's not this one. Gosh, just to give an initial guess for the state.
Could you use this to extend your problem to the case where either it's a computable sequence which has, say, ratio p of zeros and 1 minus p of 1s, or it's, say, a quantum measurement on the z basis which is offset by an amount that gives precisely probabilities p and 1 minus p?
I think you can. By the same way, the last one I told in which the directions are not orthogonal, uh-huh. I think that might work as well. Because the idea is that if you accumulate lots of bits, you will tend to see that it cannot be generated by a computer even with errors. And it should work, yeah. Because still, you have one computable sequence and one that is not computable, even in that case. Okay? So you need to accumulate as many, in a sense, evidence of the non-computability of the sequence in order to distinguish. So I think it would work.
Is it fair to understand what you're saying as the observer is basically trying to compress both sequences, and at some point, if it's computable, it's going to start to compress, and the moment that he starts to see some compressibility,
yes.
Then we say, uh-huh.
That is correct. The only problem with that,
yeah,
is that what we need to bound is a Kolmogorov complexity, and you need the best compressor for that sequence, okay? That's the only thing, but yes. What does it mean to compress a sequence? To use a compressor on that, which one is the best one for this problem? It depends. Probably if you take the binary expansion of pi and you try to compress it with WinZip, it won't compress it much, although it's highly compressible, okay? So the only problem there is that you need to pick a good compressor for the sequence you are using.
But you,
which you don't know which one is.
Right, but I mean, it looks like your dovetailing algorithm is basically walking through all possible compressions.
It's a way of saying that. Yeah, sure. If you go through all possible compressors, yeah.
And okay. So then the case which we're talking about where it's partially random and partially computable, because it's these sort of off non-orthogonal bases. You're just talking about something which is a little bit compressible, a little bit random, so it's still, in the end, going to be compressible.
Yeah, but it will be less compressible than
yeah.
the other. That's the point. So you will be able to distinguish.
Right.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if what one can say about experimental feasibility here would be something like, you know, that there are schemes for witnessing algorithmic non-randomness, right? So if I took the sequence out of an experiment and I ran all my best compression algorithms, and one fine day I discovered I could start compressing, then I would have to say, however that was generated, it was not algorithmically random.
Yeah, I think far as we knew, there was no algorithm to distinguish at the fair point from the computable sequence. But yeah, it's basically that. You need to see which one of the two is compressible or more compressible.
Does it matter that any real experimental data would also have noise? So you wouldn't.
Well, this is noise tolerant.
Okay.
Up to 21% of bit flips. You can write the same thing. You have the stop condition from the algorithm. Instead of having an equal here, you make the Hamming weight of this and this less than 21% of the bits, and then you can still bound the probability of error and make it work.
Where did that come from?
Good question. I don't know. Where was the whole problem, or?
No, the 21%.
The 21%, okay, that I can tell you where. Okay. Now, the 21%, when you write the Hamming weight, what you need to do is redo the math here, but instead of having 2 to the L different sequences that are computable, you need to count all the sequences that have Hamming weight less than whatever you need in order for this to stop, okay? And this is only convergent when this probability is less than something like 21%. I thought you were asking about the whole problem, that's why I said, okay, yeah. And just by bounding that, you said that this will converge only when the errors are less than 21%. And this 21 is not universal, it's only on this case of orthogonal directions and all that. Yes.
Since we've had the quantum randomness isn't random objection and the classical randomness is quantum randomness objection, I want to try the classical randomness is random objection. So let's say we lived in a completely classical world with deterministic laws of physics. Like, we might still imagine that a coin was giving IID random probabilities. And I think what you probably have in mind in a situation like that is that there's some interaction with degrees of freedom in the environment that we don't know about, and that's affecting the output. And then I think we're kind of imagining that the longer we ran it, like the more times we toss the coin, the more degrees of freedom in the environment become relevant, right? Like,
okay.
Like your experiment is like in thermal contact with the outside world. Like, isn't your assumption that it's computable in a classical universe kind of assuming that you've isolated this box in such a way that it's like not over time?
Well, if that classical universe is finite, then maybe the whole universe is computable. Okay, your computer here that does everything has to be outside of that universe because it has more computable power than the universe, but classical universe. But yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not sure about that assumption that every classical system keeps computable sequences. I'm not sure about that. That's just the physical Church-Turing thesis. I'm not sure if this is true or not, but if we assume that to be true, then you have this. But yeah, I'm not sure on a classical universe if you can have true randomness or not.
Could you do it in the following way? Just say, although the laws of this classical universe constitute a short program, the initial condition is an uncomputable sequence.
Sure.
And therefore, everything we measure today ultimately is uncomputable because of that initial condition.
Well, here when we talk about length of program, we are talking about the length of the program plus the input. So that's the initial condition in that case. And of course, if that initial condition is a non-computable number, it gives non-computable answers.
You need an infinite universe for that. Sorry? You need an infinite universe.
So, no,
since
any finite
or just real parameters in your theory.
Well, the way I see that, if you take the phase space, I'm going further from here. If you take the phase space from a chaotic system with two attractors, and after some time you see around which of the attractors you are going near, okay, this will be something like a classical random number generator. And this is like an amplifier of the initial conditions. Because if you knew the initial conditions with enough bits, you will be able to simulate that on a computer, okay? And of course, if those initial conditions are a non-computable number, you will obtain non-computable bits from that. And infinite in what sense? You can have, in finite space, most of the positions, if you think that positions are real numbers, most of the positions are non-computable numbers, okay? So.
In this 21% bit flip tolerance,
yes.
Does that mean then that you can only distinguish between the basis that's being used and the basis that's not being used if the basis that's not being used is far enough away? Because otherwise, the two bases are...
Yeah, I think on the noisy scenario, it might be. Or, actually, we didn't think about that, but maybe the solution to that is that if you have two bases that are too close, maybe that 21% reduces to something much smaller. I think that will be the solution, the answer to that. So 21% is for orthogonal bases, but if you go closer, maybe your noise tolerance up to, I don't know, 2% depending on how far you are.
One final thought, which is sort of half-formed, but so there are results that limit the amount of precision of any quantum measurement based on the size of the reference frame that you're using to make the quantum measurement.
Okay.
So the Wigner-Araki and Anasse theorem is an example of that. So essentially, if I want to measure one observable, then I need to have a resource which has coherent spread over the complementary observable. And there's, if there's a bound on that spread, then there's a bound on my precision. So I'm thinking that then your precision sort of is not arbitrarily high. It depends on sort of the resources that you have available in the universe. But if we're talking about simulating things like my de Broglie-Bohm model, where the program size would also somehow characterize this number of degrees of freedom in the universe, and I'm just starting to wonder whether there might be a connection, whether you can imagine a scenario where your precision is necessarily worse than it would need to be to make this distinction. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, sir.
Like whether there's some principled reasons for imprecision always being too high to achieve.
Yeah, I really don't know.
Would this imprecision be something other than the bit flip errors?
I mean, I was sort of imagining it as being some sort of random noise added to the measure. Like, if I'm trying to simulate a Z-spin measurement, it would be a slightly noisy version of that. But
how knows? I mean, these experiments of preparing a single qubit state of measuring have been done with less than 21%, so I'm not sure. I don't see if I follow exactly. I mean, all we are doing is prepare a single qubit state of measuring the spin in one direction. So the
question of how many of these measurements you have to make there.
I mean,
I can imagine that the thing will only work reliably with a really vast number of measurements. And then, you know, the fact that you get better than 21% reliability from what we've done so far, you could use the fact that those strings are way too short to test reliably this kind of hypothesis.
Now, if a single qubit has more than 21% of error for fundamental reasons, do you call that a qubit?
No,
21% is quite a lot.
I'm not suggesting that that these kinds of noise sources would give you 21% noise.
No, maybe if you go to, I don't know, continuous variable scenario or something like that.
What I'm thinking is that your reference frame degrades as you make measurements, right?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So if you are making, say, 3,000 measurements as a perceptual, but if you're making some exponentially large number of measurements, then you're going to have to keep refreshing the reference frame, which is already vastly bigger than the quantum system. Then you may run into problems with resources.
Yeah. So it's not your error rate on the first few measurements that's relevant, but it's your average error rate over the whole sequence.
Yeah.
And in these, for the, you know, the things I'm imagining, your error rate keeps going up and up and up because every time you measure spin relative to that frame,
you need here, actually that 21% means that from some moment on, the accumulated errors have to be at most 21%. Okay? Because what we are using is that for every computable sequence, there are infinitely many programs that generate that sequence. So if we don't catch the first ones because there were too many errors accumulated at the beginning, we will catch another program that generates the same sequence. Okay? So that 21% that we need is in the long run, that the limit of the probability of an error is 21%. So in the long run, at some point, you will have errors that are always at most 21%. The accumulated errors from that time on. If the error keeps growing, then it might not be the case.
In terms of the validity of Bell experiments, where eventually the eavesdropper catches on and has prediction power, there's a way to analyze these things statistically where your confidence that you're seeing non-locality is adjusted after every run. I think it's like called Martingale theory, some sort of statistical thing. Tobias, you have a friend in Maryland, he gave a presentation on this, right? On Martingale theory for Bell. I think you could do something where if you can sort of set some tolerance for how many runs you would need to see in order to have your conviction that you're seeing a non-locality violation, and then you can choose your computational resources for Alice and Bob such that you can bound, lower bound, the likelihood that the eavesdropper would be able to gain prediction by that point. Then you just, under the promise that the eavesdropper has no information before you begin, then you can go ahead and get what you want.
There's one problem with that, which is that Alice and Bob, they cannot know how long it will take the eavesdropper to start learning, because that depends upon the internal order in which the eavesdropper has the programs. And there is not such a thing as a natural order, because it depends on the universal Turing machine that the eavesdropper has picked, okay? So they might choose whatever program they want. It can be the case that the eavesdropper picks its first program and it's the exact program he needs. Or it might be the case that it takes a million bits, but there's no way for Alice and Bob to know that unless they know the prediction algorithm that the eavesdropper is using.
Okay, but can't they probabilistically assess the odds that the eavesdropper will guess it? I mean, yes, maybe the eavesdropper will guess it, but they should be able to say...
Yeah, the problem, which we discussed a lot about that, is you need a natural distribution probability over the space of programs, okay? I don't really know what that is. Basically, the space of problems is the natural numbers, okay? So how you define the good probability distribution over the set of natural numbers, if the only thing you have is that, well, Alice will try to make as hard as possible for the eavesdropper. I don't know what's the natural distribution of probability there. You are not bounded on length. Alice and Bob might be problems as long as they want. I don't know.
Or maybe they could run themselves all the possible programs that the eavesdropper might be running in parallel and try to evade all of this.
Yeah, it's like an escalator of violence.
You don't have the same sort of like argument, which is from the first part where it's KP gives you the sort of expected time to be able to.
Okay.
The program length times some constant k, like which you said was about 10 to 12, would be some sort of like if the expected amount of time it would take to start picking up on what program is being used.
Well, the thing is, I don't know how to calculate the expected amount of time.
So why not k times p, where k is the same?
Well, this is not for the learnability we use.
That's just for even start compressibility, which is
yes,
which is much weaker, right? If you can begin to maybe have some notion of compressing it at k times p, that's not the same as predicting it. I mean, predicting
yeah,
it is going to be much longer. So if you can say, let me take...
That's not for the value scenario.
But why not? Why not? Why not say...
they look for short programs to generate what they have done so far.
I want to have
yeah.
10,000 runs before we have prediction. So therefore, I should use a program which has 1,000 bits of genuine complete complexity in there, in the program itself, so that it should
so
only
that
be...
So the beginning of the sequence is the beginning of a random sequence, something like that. You're saying that?
Yeah.
Yes, you can do that, but... Yeah. Yeah, you can take a random sequence, take the prefix of whatever length you want, use that prefix and then a program. Okay? You can do that. The thing is, where do you get that prefix from? But yeah, if you get a prefix as long as you want of truly random bits, it will take long. Okay, I agree with that. The thing is, truly random bits is harder than computable. So if you think of complexity classes, it's beyond what time complexity classes are, so it's really hard to get.
Okay, thank you very much.